Okay, good morning, everybody. Boker Tov, good morning, everybody. So just before we do anything else, a couple of logistical things. We had not put on the November 16. I don't remember why we didn't do that. I think I thought I might be in England or Israel then, and I'm not. And so I'm wondering, but we perhaps cannot decide this now. Perhaps we can do it better by email. But I'm going to send a note around just to, for you to see whether or not you're free on November 16th. Okay?
Would this be in addition to?
Yes, good question. That is because I am going to be in Israel visiting my daughter on the 30th. So it would be the 16th instead of the 30th. So if you wouldn't mind consulting your calendar and just letting me know whether or not that's doable. Okay, so the idea is to swap the 16th for the 30th. Okay? All right, so we have some new people here today. So I wanted to make sure that they got a chance to introduce themselves. So, because Risa's new, and I think Carolyn wasn't here last time. So do people want to introduce themselves, people who were not here last time? Risa?
Everybody, so that she knows everybody else.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course.
I'm Risa Gabor. I live in Brooklyn. I'm out in Brooklyn. Very excited to be here.
Welcome.
Thanks. I'm sure I'll
maybe we should close the door.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm Allison and I live in Newton, my apartment.
I'm Laura Gershwin.
Laura Meyer, I live in
Newton. Nancy Gannon, Newton.
Carolyn Snyder, Newton.
Sharon Diamond,
Newton.
Sorry.
Robin Eisenman, I just joined. Sarah and Amy. I'm Newton as well.
Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Sarah Bernstein, I live in Weston.
In Bloomsdale, Newton.
Okay, and I think a bunch of people are not here tonight. And name tags are good, so I remember everybody's names.
Laura.
Laura, okay. All right, so... We are talking about the world of the Hebrew Bible today. Were people able to open up the link that I sent or the article? Is that okay? Yeah. Okay. So because I also tweaked the syllabus a little bit, so I'm going to send out another link to that. Because I want people not to have trouble sort of jumping back and forth between the syllabus and the items in the Dropbox, because that'll be important. And I'm also going to be posting the tapes of the class on this site called Podomatic. For those of you who missed or you want to listen to the tapes, we tape every class. So that will be pretty easy to get at also. Here are the latecomers. Okay, so we're talking about the Hebrew Bible today. If we get a chance at the break, I'm going to Xerox a text for us from the Babylonian Talmud, and I didn't ask you to prepare. We'll look at that together in the last few minutes. Okay, so the Bible. Is the Bible a book? It's a book about ancient Israel, so I guess that begs the question of what is ancient Israel? What are we talking about here? Hi, Diane. Hello, lady.
Sorry, we're late. Sorry.
It's okay.
It's people and place.
It's people in a place. People, Cheryl, meaning what?
The Israelites.
Okay, are they a nation? They a religion? What are we talking about?
The beginning, not yet.
Okay. So where do you get the national peace then?
After Moses.
Okay, good. So in other words, this is the core story of the Bible is the Exodus story. Right, that book, that story is really about the creation of a people. Before then you have what? What do we have recorded in the
chaos.
Well, yeah, that's like primeval chaos, primordial chaos. But what is all the textual stuff prior to the book of Exodus? What's it about? It's not about the nation.
Creation.
Okay, creation. And so that's the first few prakim, the first few chapters. The whole nature piece, right? The universe, etc. And then what? What's the rest of it? Because that's only the first few chapters of Genesis, the creation story. And then after that, we're already into this.
Noah.
Okay, Noah. Right, we already missed him. We already passed him too. We already, this past Shabbos, we were in Lech Lecha. Right, so what are we into then?
Getting together to part, Moses is...
No, you're skipping. You're bluffing. Abraham. Don't bluff. Abraham. No bluffing in here. Either you know the answer or you don't. What comes after Noah? Abram.
Gap.
Okay.
Abraham.
You got Abram.
Isaac.
Right. You got the big three. Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Right? Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. What are those stories about?
Family.
Really, fundamentally, it's like a set of very interesting, complicated individuals, marriages, family stories. The most famous, obviously, is Yaakov and his children, right? The Joseph story, etc., etc. But Bereshit, right? Sefer Bereshit, Genesis, is really like a pre-national story. Right, we read last week in the Torah portion that God says to Abram, leave this land and go to another land, and there I'm going to make of your descendants a great nation. Right, that's the whole power of the promise, and that really is the prequel to this, to the Exodus day. Right, which is part of what accounts to the power of the binding of Isaac story, because it literally doesn't make sense to say God has made this huge promise to Abram that through his descendants there's going to be a great nation, and then all of a sudden it looks like he's about to, in effect, abort the process by destroying Yitzchak. Of course, that ultimately doesn't happen, and the story continues. But you don't really have a nation here. You have some sort of a notion of a promise. But that's all. It's really just a set of relationships. That's what Genesis is about. Somebody mentioned Moshe, right? Professor Pardes, professor of comparative literature in the Bible at Hebrew University. She's really writing mainly about Moshe and following. But this is the crucial move, right? In other words, if you only had Genesis and no Exodus, right? If you sort of minus that out, you wouldn't have a national story. You would just have a kind of a set of very interesting vignettes, dramas about individuals, relationships, and families in the main. And in that sense, the move from Genesis to Exodus is probably the most important move in the Hebrew Bible. With Exodus, you get a whole different level of story, which is really the point of departure for her chapter, which is this notion of the biography of a people. Okay? So that's really what we're talking about today. Now, all right, what else? Anybody else want to comment on what I've just said? Any responses in terms of this way of seeing the Bible? Okay. So let's dig into her P piece then, this notion of imagining the birth of ancient Israel. What's she saying? What's her? I mean, this is a long piece, so and a hard piece. She's a very fine scholar. Unlike most of us, she had the willpower to turn down Harvard University when they offered her a tenure track job a few years ago. She's a very, very well respected scholar in her field. This notion of national metaphors in the Bible. What do you think she's saying? What's her main point? Before we get into the weeds a little bit and talk about some of the specifics, what's her main point about the Bible and this notion of this idea of the Bible as a kind of a literary biography of a nation? Yeah, Laura.
That it was something that the people resisted because they weren't a mature enough people to be willing to accept their own land.
Okay. And how does that therefore work dramatically? The fact that you know, you have this sort of incredibly powerful promiser, God, and a very problematic partner, which is Israel. How does that end up working dramatically? Amy, did you have a comment on that?
The whole Exodus story is really, all the symbols and the metaphors are really like the birth of a nation.
Right.
You know, from milk and honey and the shores of the sea that sunk all the Egyptians, and, you know, all these metaphors are really the birth of Israel.
Yeah. And, right, so that's, there's something extremely powerful about that in a kind of a biological way, as well as in a cultural sense, and yet, psychodynamically, the energy of the story comes from what? I mean, why is it dramatic? Why isn't it just like, okay, God's decided, I'm going to make a nation, and then he does that, gives them a Torah, gives them a document by which they live. That doesn't take up, you know, that, if you just said that, you know, like on a business plan level, well, okay, so that's like one chapter. You could just say, oh, you know, write me a business plan, and, you know, make it no more than two to four pages. Right? Where's the drama in this? Yeah, Sharon?
So they keep defying him.
Okay.
And everything that he presents before them, they either complain about or they ignore. But he keeps giving them second chances along the way.
Yeah. So that's the drama, right? The central drama is that they are recalcitrant partners. They're humans. They're not God. They're flawed. They resist it. They want to go back to Egypt. They complain that there's not enough food. The hors d'oeuvres were cold, you know, etc., etc., etc. So if you take that out, look, every story, to be good, has got to have tension. This is the central tension, which is they are reluctant partners in this. Yeah, Nancy. Yeah. Right. Right. Why do you think that is? What the lack of trust? Is it a case that it was going to happen, or it's the case the opposite, that it was going to happen and they couldn't handle the enormity of what was actually being promised? Yeah.
Well, I think that the saying ignorance is bliss is like a perfect example.
Yeah.
Because they would rather have gone back to Egypt and been slaves and doing what they knew and what they were familiar with than take a risk of the unknown.
Okay.
They were always afraid of what was lying ahead. They never thought it would be better than what they had as well. So.
Yeah. Well, okay. Right. The devil you know is better than the devil that you don't. It's a story about a promise. Amy mentioned the fact that there are a bunch of natural metaphors, sort of organic metaphors that are deployed here. But is this a natural story? I mean, is this a story about nature just playing out? Is that what Judaism is about? Like, oh yes, we're a nature cult. We just do nature. We go to the Grand Canyon and say, you know, namaste, and we go on our way. Like, is that what Judaism is about? What's it about if it's not about just, you know, namaste and just like total oneness with the natural world. What is it about? Because the Bible is the beginning of that, I think, very different trajectory. What do you think it's about? I mean, what are we living in a state of, you know, Rousseau is famous for talking about, you know, this notion of the noble savage, and we ought to try to get back to living in a state of nature. You know, we like that, at least by day, five star by night, nature by day, right? But is that really how we live? Is that what Judaism is about? Is that what the Torah is about? What do you guys think about that? Because that's also, it seems to be kind of an interesting tension in the pieces that she's bringing for us.
The Torah is about laws and rules and rituals for living your life.
Yeah, and how does that stand, Laura, vis-a-vis nature? Are those laws natural? Right. What's the Torah trying to do, and what's this promise about? Yeah, Karen.
I think it's more proactive, and it's more an active working role than just living within nature.
It's social. This is about building a community. It's about building a people. It's about Dafka not living in nature at some level. It's about doing super unnatural things. Right? And I think part of this whole issue that she's bringing up with, you know, the birth of a people is, you know, your life is about a series at some level of moves that you could say expulsions. Expulsion from the womb, expulsion from the Garden of Eden, expulsion from a state of nature. You have to build community. You have to build things. Building is unnatural. And the question is, you know, do you have the capacity to do that, and what is the trade-off that is involved in doing that? Right? And some of that is about the inertia of the present vis-a-vis the future. This notion that says, oh yeah, we already know Egypt. We don't really like being slaves, but at least we know what that is. We want bread rather than freedom. Freedom is super, you know, the freedom to, what one person's freedom is another, and one person's opportunity is another person's, like, I'm totally having a freak out because I can't handle that freedom. I can't handle the burden of responsibility. I'd rather have my mother tell me what to do. Right? My daughter, I was just with her in Israel, and I have to go back. You know, she's with a bunch of 18-year-olds, all of whom are having like an individual and collective freak out. They miss their mothers. They don't know how to do laundry. They don't know how to cook. They don't know how to do anything. So, yeah, we sort of embrace freedom as a theoretical prospect, but in reality, you know, we want our mothers to do our laundry for us. Yeah.
So in terms of what Nancy said about trust, where does, like, the divine intervention fit in as well?
Right. Because the question is that, speaking of leaving the Garden of Eden, is God going to be there forever in quite the same way, in this sort of overt way? You know, you feel his heavy hand in terms of the creation story, and you feel it in these very special places, like the mano a mano piece of, you know, battling with Paro in the plagues. Is that going to last? Right? You sit down at the Seder every year, right? And at some level, you're reading a story that you can't connect to, not just because you feel like it happened to somebody else, but do you feel that God plays that overt role in your life, in the life of the Jewish people right now? Right? If you're somebody like Elie Wiesel, or Harold Pusher wrote a very famous book about this, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? The whole premise of the book at some level is that God doesn't play an overt role in our lives the way he does in the Exodus story. And so that's a huge loss also.
And that's what she talks about. It's a story, just like all the myths, and she compares it to all the myths and fables that came before.
Okay. It's a collection of stories, the point of which are what? Cheryl, you're right to raise that, right? That's sort of one of her key points as a kind of a literary scholar. Right? That the national identity of Israel right, is one that is just super fraught with all of these boundary issues. Right? One boundary issue is the relationship between God and Israel. That's what we've been talking a lot about, right? Like, where does our responsibility end and where does God's responsibility begin? Another one, you know, if you put it in terms of, like, you know, vectors, one axis is God and Israel. Right? And so this whole question of responsibility taking, how much of this is about us taking responsibility? Is it a developmental thing? I mentioned my kid. At 18, I have a certain expectation for her rationally. Hopefully at 22, she's going to be a different kid in terms of responsibility taking. We'll see about that. But then the other one is Israel and the nations. Right? So this is one of her core points, which is that the notion of Israel creating a national identity for itself is really very much a story about how it figures out, okay, what is its relationship vis-a-vis these other partners? Do Jews want to be like, do the Israelites want to be like everybody else? No, that's the premise of the Torah. Right? We have a special kind of way of seeing the world and living in the world. What about this one? Do we want to be like God? That's a hard one. Do we want to be like God? Right? It says in Deuteronomy, right, you should be lalechet bidrachav. We should walk in God's ways. So what is the classical rabbinic take on that? You know, what does it mean to walk in God's ways? What are we talking about there?
To be God-like, I would say.
To be God-like.
To do mitzvah.
Good. Very good, right? You do the mitzvah, you're doing charity, you know, you're giving tzedakah, blah, blah, blah. You're walking in God's ways. You see somebody, you know, hungry, you feed them. You see somebody naked, you clothe them. Somebody homeless, you house them. Right, that's the rabbinic take on lalechet bidrachav, that God is merciful and just, and we should be merciful and just. Of course, what's
except
the
for
deal?
Noah.
Excuse me?
Except for Noah. Except for Noah.
Except for Noah, meaning that he's not like
that. So much mercy there. I mean, he wiped out all of
yes. Well, right, and that's a part. And that's a part. That's a part of the prequel to the national story. What? Look, first of all, why do we even have a national story in the Bible? How did the Bible begin? Are there nations at the beginning of the Bible?
No.
No? How come? Why, if this is a book all about God and Israel, so then how come chapter 1 isn't like Dickens, right? I was born. Chapter 1, I was born.
Because
there
wasn't an I.
Oh, right. All right, ladies. Thank you. Here we go. Okay. All right. What I just passed around... What I just passed around is a text from the Babylonian Talmud, tractate in Tuvot. Ketubot deals with what? What's a ketubah?
A
marital contract. Okay. So this text is taken from a tractate in the Babylonian Talmud. It was written around the year 500. That deals with marital contracts. And in particular, one issue in this particular space, in this chapter, which is the issue of what happens when there is marital discord around the issue of where a couple should live. The two obvious scenarios are they live in the diaspora, and one of them gets the Aliyah bug and wants to move to Israel. And is that okay if they are fighting and ultimately split up over that? Who's right? Who's wrong? What's the impact on the paying out of the ketubah? And the ketubah is for whom legally?
Woman.
For the woman. Protection for the woman. So the question is that something that, let's say, the woman doesn't want to go to Israel and the husband does, Does she, in effect, forfeit her right for the ketubah to be paid to her? The other scenario, of course, is the opposite one, which is they're in Israel, one party wants to leave, the other one wants to remain. You know, how does all that stuff play out? So that's sort of the backstory of the story that we're about to look at. And, you know, the Talmud does this quite often, which is it will focus initially in the Mishnah, which is a text from the year around 200. We'll deal with a very practical scenario, like what I just said, and then the Talmud will kind of unpack what the Mishnah is saying, but in the course of doing that, it will oftentimes wander a bit. It will kind of digress. It will tell stories ostensibly about the same issue, sometimes not so connected, but oftentimes quite connected, but tell you all kinds of things about the way the rabbis are thinking about things. So, but one of the key pieces of the Talmud is to recognize that there are two of them. One of them was from Babylonia, and one of them was from the land of Israel, Eretz Israel. The one from Eretz Israel is a bit older, meaning it was probably finished around 400. It's much less authoritative for reasons that I'll talk about in a second. But I'm bringing this text for us because I want you to see that what, you know, begins with the Bible in a fairly kind of literary way around this kind of sense of origin stories, ultimately, that's really not enough in terms of understanding Jewish history. In other words, the Bible is super important in Jewish life, but it ultimately is not the authoritative canonical text. The authoritative canonical text is the Talmud, right? Somebody mentioned a few seconds ago, I think Cheryl, we have two Torahs, right? We have the written one, and we have the oral one, okay? Any canonical, and that's the Talmud, right? The oral Torah is the Mishnah and the Talmud. The Mishnah adds commentaries. Why do we even have this? Historically, we have this because the world of biblical ancient Israel didn't survive. How come? What happened to it? It was destroyed by a series of different empires, right? The Assyrians in the 8th century, they destroyed Israel, right? The Northern Kingdom. And there are all kinds of legends about where those tribes went, right? Across, you know, some people feel like they ended up in places like Kurdistan, India, other, but the point is the coastal communities basically didn't survive. And then in the 6th century, the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. And then in the 1st century, the Common Era, the Romans. So the point is you have what set in motion is whatever this notion of national identity is in the Bible, the idea that says, oh, you have a nation, it has a way of life, it has a core story, it has a purpose, it has a land. All those things are kind of problematized by what actually happens in the history of Israel. The community splinters into these different groups, the groups are dispersed, right? And part of the miracle of Jewish history is that rather than just being occupied or dispersed and destroyed, they in effect reinvent themselves through the process that is partly literary and partly communal. They go to places like Babylonia, they build new forms of community there, and they build new forms of culture, and they create a new Torah. And the nation, in effect, reorganizes itself and redefines itself around doing new stuff. So, for example, one person once said, you know, all communities are about three B's. Right? I think I mentioned this last time. Behaving, believing, and belonging. So you have new forms of belonging in places like Babylonia. They're not centered around a temple anymore. They're not centered around a land. They're living somewhere else. They build new communities. They have new beliefs to some extent, including in things like an oral Torah. And they have new behavior, which are all the laws that these that are being sort of derived from these new texts. This is the miracle of diasporic Jewish life, right? Tremendous cultural and religious vitality and creativity in new spaces, right? In new communities. That's part of what enables us to survive the destruction of the Israelite nation as the Bible envisioned it. So we're about to see in this text a kind of a very interesting argument about what exactly this whole notion of diaspora Jewish life was, which is really another way of asking this question of, you know, what is the nation? Right? Must it be based in Israel? What's the ultimate basis of national identity? Is it land? Is it something else? Okay. Questions or comments so far? All right, let's take a look. Does everybody have one of these? Okay. All right, so let's start from the first big paragraph our rabbis taught. Somebody want to read that paragraph? Everybody see where I am? Left side of the page, 712 below. Anybody want to read? Diane? Please, thank you.
Taught, one should always live in the land of Israel, even in a town, most of whose inhabitants are idolaters, but let no one live outside the land, even in town, most of whose inhabitants are Israelites. Or whoever lives in the land of Israel may be considered to have a god, but whoever lives outside the land may be regarded as one who has no god. For he said, in the scripture, to give you in the land of Canaan to be your God, has he then, who does not live in the land, no God. But to tell you that whoever lives outside the land may be regarded as one who worships idols. Similarly, it is said in the scripture in the story of David that they have driven me out of this gate, that I should not cleave to the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. Now, whoever said to David, serve other gods, but to tell you that whoever lives outside the land can be regarded as one who worships God.
Okay, thank you. Alright, so we didn't really hear so much because this is a this is a paragraph that's really a conversation between two voices. One person is sort of making statements and the other voice is challenging them, and so it's a kind of a back and forth quality to it. It's hard to preserve that when you're reading it for the first time. So thank you for doing that, Diane. So our rabbis taught, right, what's the major claim the paragraph is making? It's both a kind of like an action step, but it's also a theological statement. What are they saying? Yeah?
You have to have land to believe in God, or to have God.
Okay, and just land generically, or what? Israel. You have to live in Israel, and if you don't live in Israel, it's like you have no God. Okay? Now, of course, the counter voice in the paragraph says what? What's the counter voice?
In the scripture it said, to David serve other gods. No?
Well, but you, no, don't, you skipped a little bit. So, the counter voice says what? What's the objection?
Well, what if I'm driven out?
Yeah. The counter voice is the one that we might identify with ourselves. Like, what does it mean to say that there's no God except for the people who live in Israel? How could that possibly be true? If God is a universal God in some sort of trans-spatial kind of way, how could you possibly have a theology that says God is only in one place? That would seem to be a kind of a limiting of God. That sounds much more idolatrous than the opposite, which is to say, you should definitely be in one place because you have God. By the way, are you supposed to, is your living in the land of Israel somehow contingent upon lots of other Jews living there too, according to this logic?
No.
No, in other words, they're dealing with a very real possibility that perhaps more non-Jews than Jews live in the land of Israel, and that in cultural terms, that in fact it's quite not very Jewish in Israel, and even then you're supposed to stay in the land of Israel. So, and then you know, this kind of the summative line is, if you don't live in the land of Israel, it's like you're serving idols. You're an idol worshiper. You're idolatrous. Okay, do you accept this? Do you accept this logic?
No.
Is this a working theology for you? Does this work for you? That, oh, you know, here we are. We're sitting here in Newton Center, 02459. So we must be idolaters. Because that's really what the text seems to be saying. So do you accept that?
No.
Why not? Why not? Allison?
Outside of Israel, we're all respecting the same God.
Okay, the same God. What does space have to do with it?
Yeah.
Right? Even if we want to sort of, you know, glom onto the idea there's something special about the land of Israel, we're certainly not willing to push it this far that says if you are outside the land of Israel, there's no God. So the question is, sorry, anybody else want to, you know, comment beyond what Allison said? Yeah? Joe?
So it reminds me of now you can work from anywhere because of the smartphones, so you can capitalize it anywhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. God is not reducible to space. So assuming that is true, so then why, what's the logic of the state? Like, how is it, what is it doing in the Talmud? Assuming that these people knew as much as we do, and they were as theologically sophisticated as us, whatever that means. So then, why this statement? How would you try to contextualize it? How would you understand, you know, if someone asked who wrote it, what were they, where were they from, what were they thinking about, what was their motivation? Yeah.
I think it's because of fear. I mean, they were fearful that...
Fear of what?
Just the unknown, that if you weren't in a contained group, then you might become more tempted to, you know, be an idol worshiper, or to be tempted by what everybody else was doing.
Okay, so it's fear of living somewhere else, even though, as I said before, they're aware of the fact that, they, you know, maybe and arguably in this time period, from say 70 to 500, the land of Israel is becoming progressively less Jewish.
Right.
It's being filled up with other community, the Romans, other, you know, other ethnic tribal nations, whatever. So it's not like, you know, Warsaw before the Holocaust, or New York, where you can, you know, find a kosher delicatessen on every third block. They're well aware of the fact that might not be true. So, but Jacqueline is saying, even if they knew that, there's still some sort of deeper fear that Jewish life will not be as rich outside the land. Okay, what else? Yeah, Allison?
Stresses the importance of one nation, whatever that means, wherever that is. Just the idea that we're all...
Yes, but, yeah. although it... Okay, but what's it saying about unity? What's
we all need to be together.
We all need to be physically together.
Correct.
It's not enough. It's not enough to think, oh, on a kind of a meta level, oh, as long as we're all sort of really connected to each other in some very tribal way, that's enough. It's saying, no, that's not enough. You got to be in the same place. Which, you know... Well, sorry, so now let's ask who wrote it. Anybody here ever studied Talmud? Our rabbis taught. That's a kind of a, in Hebrew. Well, first of all, I didn't give you the original, so perhaps I should have done that. Tan Ravanan. Right? This is a... this is a Hebrew statement, meaning our rabbis taught. This is a technical term that tells you that it was written in this period between 70 and 200. Okay? What's called the Tanaitic period, the Tanaim. Would anybody here ever read Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury?
Yeah.
Great story. Anybody remember that the plot of that story? Right? They're living in some kind of dystopian future, and it's a totalitarian regime, and they're trying to control people by burning all the books. And the funky, ironic piece of the story is that the firemen, the firefighters, their job is to set things on fire, not to put fires out. So they go around burning books, and the heroes of the story are these people who say, I'm going to memorize Emily Dickinson's poetry, and I'm going to go around teaching people her poetry. I'm going to memorize, you know, Anna Karenina, and I'm going to teach people that book. Bovary, Shakespeare, etc., etc., all the glories of our human civilization, the literary deposit of those civilizations. They are repeaters. That's who the Tanaim were. The Tanaim were people who were generating laws, oral Torah, and they gathered disciples, and they taught disciples their laws, their teachings. And ultimately, the Mishnah is, in effect, a kind of an edited version of that whole set of people who went around teaching in those however many, I think it's four or five generations of Tanaim. Okay? So the Babylonian Talmud here says, oh, we have an older teaching that taught you should live in the land of Israel. Who do you think, what do you think the identity was of that older Tana, that older teacher, that repeater? Where do you think that person lived? In Israel. Right? Yeah, Wendy? That's right. Absolutely. Good. So the question is... Yeah, great. So Wendy's exactly right. So the question is a strategic one, which is, in the wake of the destruction of the temple, what is the best survival strategy for the Jewish people? One strategy is to say, in a totally, like, all options are on... Like, let's put it this way. If you say... The temple has been destroyed. The physical, political, spiritual nerve center of the people has been destroyed. The strategic planning approach would be to do what?
Build another temple.
Well, but that assumes that you've already, but you made a huge assumption, which is that the regime will let you do that. The Romans were not prepared to let them do that. But from a totally rational, problem-solving, pragmatic perspective, temple's been destroyed. Your center's been destroyed. So what do?
Continue the spiritual part.
But yeah. In other words, the first thing you do, if you are totally rational, is to say, look, we have to put all options on the table. Where is our best chance for survival? Because you could say it could be Wyoming. Look at the Mormons. Did the Mormons want to end up in Utah? How come they ended up there? Anybody know about American history? Why did they end up there?
They weren't being killed there. They were
exactly killed. Very good. They were in places like Illinois. They were persecuted. They have to keep moving. So you could say, well, you know, what did the Mormons do? The Mormons did pragmatic problem solving on the fly, which is, you know what? We would have liked to stay in Illinois. They had a pogrom against us. They killed Joseph Smith. So we kept moving until we found a place where they would leave us alone. So one answer to the scenario that Wendy reminded us of, which is, you know, yeah, you get the smartest people in the community. You go on a little retreat, Milk Street caters it, right? One day retreat. All options should be on the table. Kurdistan, Utah, right? What is the best space in which we can keep this thing going? Okay? At some level, that's exactly what happens. It doesn't happen in the, like, strategic planning retreat at, you know, the Endicott Center or whatever that nice place is out in Dedham. But the point is, that's in effect what people were arguing about, which is, what should we do now? Right? So what does this voice say in that strategic planning context? What is this, the voice of this story from the Tanaim, what is this voice saying we should do?
Stay.
Stay. Now, the reason why this voice ultimately, we'll see in a second, loses is because somewhere in this period, from 70 to 200, something even worse happens, arguably. At least in political and demographic terms, maybe not spiritual terms. What's the other calamitous event that happens to the Judeans, the Israelite, the Jews in Israel after the destruction of the temple? Anybody know? What other calamity was visited upon them? Or in some way they brought it upon themselves, but...
Messiah?
No, that's Bar Kokhba. Right? Around the year 135. Right? That was a, in some ways, an even more titanic uprising against the Romans. And the Romans really said, you know what, these Jews are driving us crazy, we are going to basically extirpate them root and branch from Israel. We can't deal with them. By the way, this is one of the great what-ifs of Jewish history. What would have happened if we had just allowed ourselves to be colonized like most other peoples did? Right? In other words, if we hadn't, you know, empires are pretty common in world history. Most people did not necessarily take the view that says, oh yes, we need to resist militarily the imperial occupying regime. We can perhaps take the view that, you know, we should just kind of wait them out and eventually they'll get weak and they'll totter and they'll fall. And we will be left with our country. The Jews didn't do that. They resisted in 66 to 70, and the temple got destroyed. We were lousy learners. We did it about 70 years later. They kicked our butts again, and we were pretty much driven out of our land. This story that we just read is probably a story that was written by a Tana in the context of that, of those, that set of waves of destruction. And so what's he watching? What he's watching is people leaving. And the question is, how does he get people not to leave? Practically, it's probably a bad idea to stay. The future is not very bright in Palestine, in Roman Palestine. So what's the only argument you have to make that's going to keep people from leaving?
You won't have a God.
It's his only... the only card he really has to play. If you leave, it'll be like you're losing God. Did it work? No. All right, let's read the second paragraph. Somebody want to read the second one? Who wants to read?
I'll read.
Thank you.
R is
there. Rebbe. R is for Rebbe.
Rebbe Zera was evading Rav Judah because he desired to go up to the land of Israel, while Rav Judah had expressed the following view. Whoever goes up from Babylon to the land of Israel transgresses a positive commandment. For it said in Scripture, they shall be carried to Babylon. There they shall be until the day that I remember them, said the Lord. And Rabbi Zera, that text refers to the vessels of ministry. And Rav Judah, another text also is available. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the hinds of the field, that you waken not nor stir up love until it please. And Rebbe Zera, that implies that Israel should not go up altogether if it's surrounded by a wall.
Do you get the back and forth here?
Yeah.
Right? They are arguing with each other. Rebbe Zera is arguing sort of for X, and Rav Yehuda is arguing for Y. And every time they bring the proof text, which is the italics, they are in effect saying, no, no, what you just said was wrong, and here's my argument, here's my proof for what I'm saying. So I just wanted to, as Laura reads through, read it that way, which is that they are arguing with each other about whether or not you should go up to the land of Israel or not. Jill, did you have a comment you want to make?
Why is one Rebbe and one?
Okay, great. Why is one called Rebbe and one's called Rav? Anybody know anything about that?
Was Rav a teacher or not?
Yes, but that's sort of a generic word for teacher. The reason why one is called Rebbe and one's called Rav is because only if you had your rabbinic ordination from an academy in the land of Israel were you called Rebbe, Reish Bet Yud in Hebrew. If you had studied in Babylonia, you were just Rav. So part of what's going on here, you got Rabbi envy here, that's what's going on here. Part of what's going on here is, who is the student of whom?
No.
Look at it. Rebbe Zera was evading Rav Yehuda. Who is the master of whom? Who evades whom? The student evades the teacher. Right? Rebbe Zera, and we'll see, so the interesting dynamic is Rebbe Zera was a Babylonian who had gone to Israel to learn in a Talmudic rabbinic academy. He'd gotten his ordination and he'd come back to Babylonia. So it's kind of an interesting tension. He is a student of Rav Yehuda, even though he has a more prestigious ordination than his teacher did. So you got the ordination piece, but you also have the generational dynamic piece. So how come he wants to get away from his teacher? How come he's sort of ducking, like, oh, I got to go out, my teacher, I got to go down the corner to Packy store to get a pack of smokes, and then he thinks he's going to run away to Israel. That's kind of the scenario. Why is he evading him? Why doesn't he just tell him point blank, look, I want to go back to the land of Israel? Why is he evading? Why doesn't he have the guts just to tell him, oh, I've decided to make Aliyah, I've decided to return to the land of Israel, I'll come. Because what's Rav Yehuda teaching? What's his view on going up to the land of Israel? What does he say? Okay, what does that mean? What does it mean to say you transgress a positive commandment to leave Babylonia, to go up the land of Israel? What does that mean? This is halakhic language now. This is not theological language, it's halakhic language. Yeah?
You're breaking a law.
Okay. Are you aware of the fact that it's a law, it's a positive commandment, like giving tzedakah or keeping Shabbat? Are you aware of the fact that it's a positive commandment to live in the land of Babylonia, to live in the diaspora? Are you aware of that?
No.
How come? How come? Why don't you know that?
Because the paragraph before says the opposite.
Okay. In other words, what are you sort of saying? Not only is there a major disjunction here between the two paragraphs, as the Talmud is kind of setting this thing up, but who do you think made that law up? It says, oh yeah, it's a positive commandment to live in Babylonia. It's a positive commandment to live in 02459 or 02446. Right? Who made that up?
The Babylonians.
They're passing new laws. And surprise, surprise, the basis of the nation now is what? Is the basis of the nation now about Eretz Israel?
It's more about how people are.
It's more about where the people are. Very good, Cheryl. It's about a certain very pragmatic view of this is where the critical mass of the community is. Don't leave it. Right? It's a kind of a redefinition of what the nation is. The nation is still a physical thing, as in where people actually are, But the question is, where's the critical mass of the people? Right? If you look at a picture of Polish Jewry before the Holocaust, right, 1935, whatever, there are these wonderful, now of course they're heartbreaking, a picture of a kiosk in Warsaw. Right? At the kiosk you might see dozens of Jewish newspapers. Some written in Polish, some written in Russian, some written in Hebrew, some written in Yiddish. That's what this guy is saying. How could you possibly leave Warsaw? This is the Jewish motherland. This is the heartland of Jewish life. A shul on every block. Multiple Jewish worldviews. The Bundes, the communists, the Zionists, the left-wing Zionists, the right-wing Zionists, the religious non-Zionists, the religious Zionists. This is the heartland. How could you possibly leave it?
Did they truly believe that, though?
Absolutely.
They didn't feel jealous that they couldn't be in Israel.
Well, the question is, what's better? So Carolyn's asking a good question. What's the argument for believing it? I mean, it's also begs the question of what belief is. But what's the argument for saying that you can't leave Warsaw? You can't leave New York. You can't leave Tel Aviv. You can't leave Babylonia. What's the ultimate argument for it?
Family.
It's not just family.
This is the
richness of Jewish life. We killed ourselves to build these amazing communities. Why would you move to Wyoming? But look, first of all, you all, many of you, I know you all varying degrees. Your kid comes home and says, "Oh, I'm applying to the University of Wyoming." What are you going to say?
No.
No? How come? How come? Aside from you don't want to fly all that way to visit them. There's no Jews there. How many of you come from very small Jewish communities? Okay. So how come you're here? Risa, where do you come from?
Nova Scotia.
Beautiful place. What, all kinds of wonderful things about it. So what's better, Brookline or Nova Scotia?
Brookline.
Okay. How come?
Larger community.
Okay. So this is what they are saying, which is, look, what they are saying is, it's not our fault that Babylonia is stronger than Eretz Israel. The point is, that's a function of history. Right? Hitler, Stalin in our time, what was will probably never be again in Eastern Europe. It's not a question of fault, it's a question of this is actually what happened. You want to do magical thinking and still pretend that life is the same in Nova Scotia as in Brooklyn? Be my guest. But the point is, materially, it's not. That's what Risa just said. Right? Warsaw of 1935 is not Warsaw of 2015. That's a tragedy. It's not the same as what I did in a second. The point is, what they're saying is, it is what it is.
Which one? Oh my God!
Seriously? So cute.
Which one? I know.
So that's what. Don't worry. That's what the Babylonian voice is saying is, history brought us to Babylonia. We made the best of it. Actually, and that history went all the way back to the destruction of the first exile. The prophet of the first exile, Jeremiah, says in his book, in his prophecies, God sent us here. What should we do here? Build community. Build businesses, build a good life. That's what they did. The fact that the Jews of Eretz Israel had the bad luck, they had to deal with the Romans, they had the temple burned down. The point is, it's all a part of the calculation that says, what is the best basis for maintaining the nation? The argument is, the best basis is, where can you build the strongest community, Brookline or Nova Scotia? Which is a function of stuff like war and peace. Economics, trade routes, like all kinds of, you know, climate, a tsunami, an earthquake, God forbid. All kinds of things go into the calculus, But at the end of the day, you know the difference between Nova Scotia and Brookline. And you can talk and try to deny it, but it is what it is. That's why you don't want your kid in Wyoming. There are other reasons for them to go to Wyoming. Oh, I want to study cattle. God forbid I have tuberculosis or asthma. I need to be in a Rocky Mountain climate. Like, there are lots of other reasons, but those have nothing to do with the maintenance of a community. And so what the Babylonian voice is saying is, history brought us to this place. We made the best of it. We made a Talmud. We made a second Torah. We have these rabbinic academies. We have kosher food. We have mikvahs. We have all this cultural critical mass. You don't have it. And this is, in effect, a kind of a rethinking of what the nation is. The nation is now about Torah. It's not about temple. The nation is wherever the strongest community is. It's not about the land of Israel in a vacuum. This text was so powerful in terms of creating a new concept of nation that this was the text the Zionists had to figure out how to defeat. Because when we get to the Zionists, you know, they were living in these very rich places, like Warsaw. And they had to make what was a totally counterintuitive argument, which was go back to a land that nobody lives in. And it'll be better than Warsaw. It'll be better than New York. Did people buy that, by the way?
No.
Only some? Most didn't. They said, no, I'll stay in Warsaw. I want to read 14 newspapers a day. I want a synagogue on every corner. I want a critical mass of a city of 200,000 Jews. I want to live in an empire with 5 million Jews. Right? Other Jews chose what Reese's family did, which, well, I want to choose an opportunity, and I'll do my very best to live in a tiny community in a place like Nova Scotia. Right? But the point is, this is what Israel what Zionism was struggling with, was the logic of this text, which in some ways, which was a much more naturalistic view of Jewish history that says, don't leave community, ever. Because it takes a lot of work to build a new one. And you may not succeed. Don't leave your rabbi, don't leave a school, don't leave a place with a mikvah, with a shulchan. If you do that, you're asking for trouble. Is that a good recipe for Jewish continuity? Don't leave? Yes or no?
It depends on,
I mean, think about the Purim story. Right? It depends if you've got Ahasuerus, the nice guy, in chapter 1, and then at the very end, or the guy in the middle who's listening to Haman. It depends if you get Hitler or Stalin or the King of England. Like, it depends on a lot of different pieces that you, by definition, you can't know in advance what's going to happen. Yeah?
It depends who you have in Israel.
Absolutely.
And what makes that less.
That's right. It depends on what's going on in Israel. But so this text, this idea that says, you should stay with the community. This basically becomes the political philosophy of the Jewish people for about 1,500 years. This is, and by the way, this text you will find on walls, literally on walls, in anti-Zionist neighborhoods in Israel today. Places like Mea Shearim, B'nai Brak, other places. This text is sort of one of their core texts for the sin of Zionism. That Zionism breaks with this text because Zionism basically says that, you know what, we don't care about what the Talmud said about God, in effect, sending us into exile, and we shouldn't leave until he takes us out. We should rebuild the land ourselves. Okay, questions or comments?
Yeah.
Stay in Babylonia. Okay, so I'll see you in a couple weeks. I'll send around an email
next week,
pardon me, next week. I'll send around an email in terms of the reading, but also consult your calendars, and I'll do another email thing about November 16th. The question was, I have to be in Israel visiting my daughter on November 30th, so there's no class November 30th, so I propose to have class on the 16th. Okay? So the question is, no, the question is, are people available on the 16th?
I think it's
a matter of time. All right, goodbye, guys. Anybody who hasn't registered, please be in touch with me. So send me, do you have the original email? Do you want me to remind you?
I'm going to be here.